So, number one, sometimes meditation is easy and sense is easily got without effort. Sometimes the world seems so sticky and things just don't drop and meditation is stuck. Any comments? I know, train oneself in valuing letting go and peace. There you go. You already know. Why did you ask the question if you already know the answer? Gee. No, it's just after a while that things just drop by themselves. So you just be the passenger on the journey. Soon everything disappears. When sitting meditation today, I felt very calm, but in this dreamy, lazy sort of state. Not asleep, but when I got up to do walking meditation, I had this feeling of wanting to go back to sleep, even though I hadn't been asleep really while sitting. Complicated. In another sit, my body felt like it was paralyzed. Felt calm though. Can you explain what is going on? No. You figure it out. Okay. So be very careful, because when you do a long retreat, after a while, it's not sloth and torpor anymore in the sense that you're tired. You get enough sleep. Sometimes it's just being bored. So that's why you're supposed to make it interesting. So in other words, break the habits. Do it slightly differently. When you're meditating, sit in the other direction, just because it's slightly different and it will make you more awake. Don't always sit in the same chair when you're meditating. You can sit up here if you want. That will wake you up. And then I'll ask you a question. If you're very sleepy where you're doing walking meditation, do backwards walking meditation. That will keep you awake. In other words, don't be a creature of habit who always does the same thing the same way at the same time, because that means you die. You know, you just get bored out of your skull, so do it differently. So that's why we got all these different methods of meditation. And I don't know, have I taught you the backwards breath meditation yet? Did I do that yet? Okay, I'll now teach the backwards breath meditation. Bit of exercise, you have to join in on this one. Now, when I say go, not yet, when I say go, I want you to close your eyes, breathe in and out three times. At the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Easy instructions? Okay, go. Just breathe in and out three times. At the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Just a three. Some people can't count to three. Okay, that was very easy, wasn't it? No problem at all. Now, when you breathe in and out three times, you started with the in-breath. In, out, in, out, in, out. Now, I want you to do exactly the same exercise, but when you close your eyes, breathe out first, then in. Out, in, out, in. And at the end of the third in-breath, open your eyes. Okay, go. Now that is backwards breath meditation. You breathe out first and then in. Surprisingly, it feels different. It's actually not the same. It's weird. When I breathe in and out, in, out, in, out, that's one way, but breathe out first, then in, out, in, out, in. It feels different. That's why it's called backwards breath meditation, a totally different form of meditation. Never heard before, until you came to this crazy monk who teaches the Jhana Grove. All it does, it makes it a tiny bit more interesting, just by changing things around a bit. And if that doesn't work, you may try the other invention, is three in-breaths to one out-breath. Now you see that when you laugh, you wake up. No one gets sloth and torpor during the evening Q&A sessions, do they? The reason is because it's fun, it's weird, strange, do things slightly differently, it wakes you up. Now that's how you overcome the sloth and torpor. Do it strange, do it weird. If you had this feeling of wanted to go back to sleep when you're doing the walking meditation, or if your body felt like it was paralyzed, you can try this wonderful method of walking meditation using a mantra. I've already mentioned mantras, you know, your left foot, you know, shut, your right foot up, shut up, shut up, shut up. Now that's one way of doing it, but there's a much more powerful way of using a mantra while you're doing walking meditation. I really recommend this. It overcomes sloth and torpor very, very quickly. So, you move your right foot and you say to yourself, I will die. Your left foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die. Now that keeps you awake. But this is not just a joke, because at first when people do this, they think it's funny. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And then after they stop laughing, they think, my goodness, actually that's the truest thing you could ever say. There's no doubt about that. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And then you come across fear. I will die, that's for sure. My goodness, could be any time. I will die, that's for sure. And you keep on walking. I will die, that's for sure. Get to the end of the path, turn around. I will die, that's for sure. When you get through the fear, you get incredible peace. I will die, that's for sure. All this stuff I keep thinking about and worrying about, it's useless. It doesn't have any value anymore. I will die, that's for sure. All these little concerns I have about people making noise, banging, talking, all the problems in my life, all my financial problems, business problems, social problems. So what? I will die, that's for sure. You let go. And when you let go big time. And you're sitting there, dead man walking. It's great. So that's like being innovative when you're walking. It's not just doing the same old stuff. Try that, it really works, but you really got to do it, you know, consistently for a long time. And notice those stages. The stages of, you know, this is the joke. And then that's just the way that you react. And then fear. And actually truth, realizing this is actually truth. And from truth to fear, and fear to letting go. That's what happens. It's brilliant. Can you explain what is going on? Yeah, in Bhante Ji's book, Mindfulness in Plain English, he talks about mindfulness and samadhi sometimes being out of balance. Is this what is happening? Although I don't quite understand how sati and samadhi can be out of balance. If samadhi sustains sati on a single object, is this samadhi composed of sati? And I think what they usually think of samadhi is suppression. So suppression, if you suppress too much, sometimes you suppress the wrong things. It's like letting go. You've got to remember to let go of the right things. Don't let go of your mindfulness. Don't let go of your restraint. Ajahn Brahm says let go. So I've got to let go of all these rules. I'm going to have a sandwich this evening. I'm going to make myself. It's because he said let go, for goodness sake. Now you've got to know the right things to let go of. But if you let go of just your mindfulness, or let go of stillness, then you get to go to sleep. But what really samadhi is, when it's really stillness, then that encourages mindfulness. When you're mindful, you can be still. So really, the two support each other. Where he says balance, he was thinking that, you know, too much samadhi, in the sense of controlling, and that's a concentration type samadhi, which is the wrong, which is really silly way of looking at it. Because imagine if samadhi was concentration. You concentrate, 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 concentrate. You get tired. And that does dull out sati. Sati becomes very weak if you work so hard trying to concentrate. And there you may have a problem. But if you remember that samadhi is not concentration, it's not hard work, it's stillness coming from letting things go, putting things down. Remember it's stillness. And then there's no such thing as out of balance. The two support each other and they grow and grow and grow together. So sometimes you get tired because you've been working too hard. You don't need to work hard. Ah, I don't want to leave. How long is this waiting list to become a monk at your monastery? Ordain me. They don't sign it. Oh, what's it? No, yeah. I agree. I don't want to leave either. How long is the waitlist to become a monk at your monastery? Do you want to go on the fast track? Fast track. This actually happened once. This man, he arrived at our monastery in Thailand. And he was actually just a tourist. He came over, he finished his degree in England, and he got like a free ride to Singapore, and just was working his way back to England. And he just turned up at our monastery. No, what happened? He was in Bangkok, and there was some of these, voluntary workers, aid workers, who were helping in the refugee camp, local. And so they said, oh, do you want to come see a refugee camp? So I said, oh, I'm not doing anything. He went to the refugee camp. And then they said, well, the only other Westerners here are the monks. Do you want to come and have a look at a monastery? He said, oh, yeah, I'd love to see a Buddhist monastery. He wasn't a Buddhist, but he came to the Buddhist monastery. And then sort of he asked to stay the night. And the next morning he shaved his head and asked to become a monk. You know who that was? That's Ajahn Amaro. He's now the abbot of the monastery in England. Now that's the fast track. So what, if you really want to become, whoever wrote this, shave your hair tonight. See me tomorrow morning, and then you make you an abbot of a monastery somewhere. Dear Ajahn, what are you chanting after you receive lunch? You know that. Oh, well, for what we're about to receive, may the Buddha protect us. It's a protection chant. That's what I do, because we don't know, you know, what you put in the food. We do that chant, you know, just in case. No. All it means is, like, for all the donors, may all your illnesses and troubles disappear. May you have long life, happiness, beauty, and strength. That's what we say. This is a blessing. And it's not just say, you know, I'm using my power for this to happen. It's just the knowledge. It's the law of karma. So, you know, someone has made that food, offered the food, presented the food, and that generosity, that has a karmic effect. Now, you give health to somebody else by offering food, you get health back. You know, you give long life, you get long life back. Good food, you get, you know, good looks. Not good looks, but I mean you look healthy. So that's what you get back. And you get happiness. Whatever you give to other people, you get back. So be careful not to criticize anybody. You loud person. At the end of the retreat, tomorrow, so are you going to tell that person off? You've got all the list of things. Just before you go, the person in my cottage, I just want to tell you a few things. If that's what you give them, you'll get it back. Usually many times over. So that's what we do, the chanting after lunch. Ah, this is a really good question. Shall we have an all-night question and answer session? Okay, yeah, well, I'll go on to maybe 9 o'clock, and will you carry on afterwards? And you can do the first shift until 2 a.m., and you can do the 2 a.m. till 6 o'clock shift. I mean, the nuns, you can do some Q&A as well. Most supreme and boundless emptiness. I should keep all of these. Thank you for this wonderful retreat center. We are so blessed. Indeed, you are. Ajahn Brahm, do you think some people need a more regimented, strict routine of practice? Yes. Sit up! No, they don't. People need more compassion. They don't need to be told more things. There is, in the Chinese Art of War, there was the story of the general in the Imperial Army who had the best discipline. His soldiers were noted for never disobeying orders. And so the emperor, he called him to the palace, and he wanted to find out, what's your secret? Because, you know, you're so well known in your regiment, all of the soldiers never disobey your orders. What's the secret of such amazing discipline? And the general replied, Yes, Your Majesty, or Your Imperial Majesty, whatever it is. The reason why, you know, all my soldiers have got such good discipline and never disobey orders is because I only tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. That's why they never disobey. That's a wonderful little saying. He only tells the soldiers to do what they want to do. That's why they always follow the orders. And of course, it's much more deep than that. Because the soldiers have to want to get up early in the morning. They have to want to train really hard. When it comes to a battle, they have to want to go into battle knowing they'll probably get wounded or even killed. But the trick of the discipline was that the general was a very, very great motivator. He motivated his troops so well that they wanted to get up early in the morning. They couldn't wait for the bell to ring to get up. They loved training. They just wanted to be fit and healthy and skilled. So they couldn't do enough training. And when it came to a battle, he motivated them with patriotism or service to the emperor or whatever it was. So again, they were just waiting for the orders. Come and give the orders. We want to fight. And that was the reason why they had such good discipline. He motivated them so that when the order was given, they were only doing what they really wanted to do. That is the secret of discipline. In a monastery, in a retreat center, in a business. If you motivate a person, then you don't have to tell them what to do. And that's why in this retreat, to have it regimented with a strict routine or practice, it doesn't work. My job is to motivate you to want to get up early in the morning, to want to meditate, to enjoy it. And then it doesn't have to be a regimented routine anymore. For example, if you had a teacher like yourself, or if we had a teacher like Ajahn Chah, do you think your progression would have been different? No. It doesn't really matter what the teacher is, because it's really up to you what you do. The teacher can actually put you here and say, sit down. But how many of you rebel if you're told what to do? So instead of like telling you what to do and rebelling, they can sit you down here, but they can't tell you what to think. You do need to have that motivation to be convinced why to meditate, how to meditate, and especially to see the beauty in it. And that's where you make the progress. Sometimes I wish that you would build these really tall meditation platforms and leave us up there. That was a story of in Laos, just before the Vietnam War, where the communists took over Laos. There was a very famous meditation monastery. We heard stories about it. And the abbot there would take the new monks on a walk through the jungle all day until they were sweaty and tired. And when they just maybe at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the evening, they'd always manage to come to this clearing in the middle of the jungle with these really, really tall trees, gorgeous trees. And the monks had built platforms high up in the branches, maybe 100 foot, 200 feet high. And the platforms were just the size of those mats which you sit on. And there were little bamboo ladders to going up to those platforms. And he would send the monks up, one monk to one platform. And then he'd take the ladder away and say, I'll be back tomorrow morning. And so there the monks had to sit tired, sweaty, high up, there was no railing. You just had to sit there, there's no way to stretch. And if you did get sleepy, you would fall to certain death. If you did get injured, the tigers and the animals would eat you at night. And they say that many monks got amazing meditation up there. That's what they say. They don't say anything about the monks who didn't make it. They never lived to tell the tale. That's the trouble with all these monk stories. The ones who survive, they're the ones who tell the tale. Say, wow, it worked. But that sort of stuff, you know, you can meditate through fear. And that's really what it is, fear of dying. But that's not really the way to develop deep meditation. What happens then? Yeah, you're up on the platform, you can get deep meditation, come back to the monastery and you fall asleep. It doesn't really work. So instead of getting up because I have the option to, I just have to deal with my restlessness. No, it's much better actually to deal, you know, with the why you don't want to get up, why you want to be restless. Instead of forcing you to use willpower, it's always wisdom power to contemplate. When you wake up in the morning, why don't you want to get up? And what's it like when you just lay there in bed? And after a while, it doesn't feel good. And you're just wasting time and just the body doesn't sort of get any better. There's a certain amount of sleep you can get, and more sleep, it just makes you just feel awful. And it's good to get up. It feels good to get up. Which is why when you get up in the morning, you should be like me. You jump out of bed and go zippity-doo-dah, sadhu, 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 it's 4 o'clock, yes, another day in meditation. Try it. I mean, put energy when you get out of bed and do that before you realize what you're doing or what time it is. Otherwise you'll stop. If you think about it, you can't do it. You just go and do it. And you put energy up and you really feel good. But imagine, I have a pain which will never go away despite sending lots of loving kindness to it. What is that pain? Is that your husband? Your what? Your favorite monk? Can you please tell us about primary and secondary meditation objects? Should the pain be ignored or focused on? What about the breath? Okay, if the pain is physical and you can just move your body, then move the body, for goodness sake. If it's, say, a headache, take more liquid or even a Panadol if you really need to. So if a pain which never go away, despite sending lots of loving kindness to it, remember just the loving kindness is a very hard thing to do and to do it well. So Panadols are very easy, or aspirin, you just take one in there and you put it in there and mindfully drink the water. And it's amazing just how that works. So don't be stupid, you know, and think, no, you know, sort of, I've just been bitten by a snake, I'm going to give it loving kindness. May the wound be happy and well. Call an ambulance, for goodness sake. Sometimes people can be stupid like that. Anyway, so first of all, if you've got a pain, and if it really is a big pain, then move, do something about it, sort of stretch, you know, take some Panadol or whatever, go and see a doctor or whatever. But most of these pains, they're just like a bit of irritations. And those are sort of pains you can get rid of with loving kindness. And primary and secondary meditation objects, I'm not quite sure what you mean here, but I did mention that whatever you put in the center of your screen of attention, that stays. So if I'm watching my breath, I can feel a pain, say my knees. I'm watching my breath, it's like in the center of my screen is my breath. And I can just feel on the edge of the screen is the pain. But I don't put the pain in the center of the screen. Because if I do, then I lose the breath. I just keep the breath in the center of the screen. And quite often, as you focus in, just the breath, the pain falls off the screen. You lose contact with it, and you can't feel it anymore. It just disappears. But if it really is strong pain, then quite automatically it takes center screen. And the pain becomes, you know, your object of meditation. And then you can try and give it kindness. And if it doesn't work, if it doesn't go away, then move, get up, and deal with it. There was another of my fellow monks, and he was sitting meditation. He got pain in his knees. And he decided just to enjoy it. Just that I'm going to push through this, endure pain. Sit through pain, they called it. And he sat and sat and he endured and endured and endured. And then we had to take him to hospital where he had a double knee reconstruction. That was really stupid. People can do that, you know. We're so stupid. Now, I'm tougher than the pain. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to be, this is it, enlightenment or bust. The last night of the meditation retreat. This is it. I've been waiting all my life for this. Now I'm going to sit here. And I'm not going to move no matter what. And that's the ambulance cases. Can you elaborate on the relationship between nama-rupa and consciousness? How is it that we are all interacting in a mutually phenomenal world? Are all consciousness somehow linked? Thanks. Oh my goodness me. I keep it simple. So nama-rupa is the objects of your consciousness. In the same way that on a TV, Nama Rupa is like the programs on the TV screen. Channel 1, channel 2, channel 3, 4, 5, 6. And consciousness is the screen on which it's all played out. You can't have a program without a TV screen. If there's a TV screen, there's going to be a program on it. The two go together. So when one of them disappears, the other one has to disappear. That's why the Buddha said, like two sheaves of reeds. When one is taken away, the other one falls away. So that's keeping it simple, and that's from the suttas. When it gets to the Abhidharma, they really make it very, very complicated, and it's not the same as the Buddha said. So Nama Rupa is like the objects of consciousness. And consciousness is the screen on which it's all played. How is it that we are all interacting in a mutually phenomenal world? Are we, or is it just you? Nothing to do with me. At the Dharma Hall in Bodhinyana, I saw people lying down, taking naps. Oh my goodness. Was that you guys? Ooh. Is this disrespectful in such a setting, or given the heat? Oh, look, if you want to lay down, that's what your rooms are for. It's called beds. That's a meditation hall. It's not a sleeping hall. So if you want to go to sleep, go in your rooms and go to bed. That's what the pillow is there and the mattress is for. So don't just go sleeping in the Bodhinyana hall. Because when you go to sleep, you start to snore. And there may be someone meditating about to get into jhana. Oh my goodness, and you spoil them. And that, if you stop someone getting into jhana, stop getting into enlightenment because you snore, imagine the karmic effect of that. Now that really is big, bad karma. And people who snore a lot like that, because they go into the meditation hall, they snore in front of the Buddha. Snoring in front of the Buddha is such great bad karma, you get reborn as a pig in your next life. So be warned, be careful. Most venerable cessation. You discuss spiritual materialism, but I have identified in myself a strong current of spiritual hedonism. Oh, that's interesting. That is that jhana and enlightenment are the big spiritual orgasm. Description of jhana I have read cover the spectrum from still, calm, refined, subtle to blissful, rapturous, better than sex, and the Christian tradition, ecstasy. Could you please clarify? Yes, it is beautiful and blissful. And the Buddha said you can get into that. Get off on it. He said there are many other pleasures in the world which are dangerous, which hinder your progress. But the pleasures of meditation, he said, are beneficial for your progress. So don't be afraid of it. You can indulge in it. So being a spiritual hedonist is actually okay. It's recommended by the Buddha. Have fun. That's the thing I said earlier on with religion, that too often people think that religion means you can't have any fun at all. And people are really amazed. They come in here and they see a monk telling jokes. Why are you amazed? Can't a monk have fun? I don't mean like, none. What fun does a monk have? None. They can't have monk having other types of fun and joy and be happy and joyful. Of course they can. So that is why sort of the happiness from meditation is actually encouraged. And I also mentioned earlier on about the Dhammacetya Sutra, King Pasadena noticing that all the monks in Jetavana Monastery are always happy and smiling. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what happens when you meditate. So you do get happiness in meditation. So you can enjoy that. Further, I know a lot of Dharma practitioners whose initial spiritual inquiry was sparked by experience of recreational drugs and who are perhaps questing after this experience in meditation in perhaps a delusive way. Please discuss. I don't know about recreational drugs. I didn't inhale. That's good to know. No, actually, my friends were getting into recreational drugs, but I never got into them. And mostly because it's just a personal story, one of my best friends, he was taking some marijuana and he got busted. And I remember going home on the bus with him and he said his father had found out and he said his life was really, really difficult. And at that time my father was really, really on the edge of life and death. And when I heard what happened to him, I said, if I took drugs and I got caught, that would kill my father. Now, I mean, really kill him, because he was very, very weak. So out of love for him, I said, no, I'm not going to take those drugs. And then later on, after my father died, that's when I got into meditation. And the teachers there said, no, drugs and meditation don't mix. So that's how I was very lucky to avoid those things. And my practice was, so I'm not quite sure if many Dharma practitioners, maybe those old hippie meditation practitioners used to take recreational drugs, but there was this one guy I remember, and actually he was a drug dealer who became a monk. He would smuggle drugs and also take it himself. And he said it took him about 2 years to clear his mind of the fog when he became a monk. You know, just the results of taking drugs and just the lack of mindfulness which it engendered in the mind was just so strong. About 2 years and he was back to normal again. So it really is just muddles up your mindfulness. You don't need it. You get much more bliss and happiness just with clear mindfulness. You don't need the drugs. Sorry. Thank you so much for being the most inspiring person on the planet. That's pretty good. You haven't been around very much, have you? You got a question, yeah? Oh yeah, that's why he said there's four types of path to enlightenment. There is slow with lots of suffering. There's slow and happy. There's fast with lots of suffering. And there's fast with lots of happiness. So which one do you choose? When I saw those four, I said, I'll take the last one. Fast and happy. And it's really, you don't actually choose it. It just depends upon how many defilements you have. The more defilements, the more attachments, the more pain it's going to be. And the more your spiritual qualities and things like of stillness and mindfulness, the stronger they are to begin with, the faster it is. Dear Ajahn, in Majjhima Nikaya, one of the sutras, the Buddha talks of to his newly ordained son, Rahula, the advice to Rahula Sutta. He gives him advice on reflecting upon his actions, speech, as well as thoughts. When talking about speech, the Buddha says, Rahula, don't lie, even if it is a joke. I sometimes tell silly jokes, which do include a white lie. There is no bad intention, only to brighten up a moment. What is your stance on this, please? Okay, this becomes actually one of the rules of Vinaya. What it means, what the Buddha was telling Ananda, don't tell like a lie, as a joke, saying, oh, now, Daniel, I'll meet you just outside after the talk. And then I'll leave you outside, hour after hour after hour, ha, 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 ha. That is like a lie, which you do out of fun, but it's still a lie. If it's a story about the rabbi, the monk, and the priest, which never really happened anyway, have I told that story yet? Okay, well this didn't happen. It's a lie, in the sense that I make it up. But you know it's a lie because it's a joke. So it doesn't deceive anybody. So if it deceives somebody, you think it's really serious, and you go and wait for me outside. Now that's what the Buddha was saying. Don't just lie like that. But if it's like a funny story, then that's not a lie. It's a metaphor. So anyway, there was a rabbi, and there was a priest, a Catholic priest, and there was a monk. And they were doing interfaith work. In other words, they were trying to discuss each other's religions, to try and get some harmony between all these great religions of our world. And they realized just discussing things wasn't really good enough. They had to really develop some friendship. So they started having lunch together, once a week. And even that wasn't enough, just socializing. They had to really get a bit closer together. So after lunch, they went to one another's rooms there, and they started playing just like some small games, like Monopoly or cards or whatever. Just to do things together, because that's actually how you build up friendships. And then one thing led to another, and they started playing cards, they started playing poker. And just to make it interesting, they first started betting on small things. And one thing led together, and they started some serious gambling, the three of them. And in that particular place, that was actually illegal. And so they got busted and arrested by the police for illegal gambling. And so they had to go to court. And at the trial, the judge called the rabbi up first of all and said, look, you know, you're a leader of a religion. I'm just going to ask you straight up, were you gambling? And the rabbi did what I used to do at school, crossed fingers behind his back and said, no, I wasn't gambling. You know, because at school, if you did that, that meant you weren't really that. If you just cross your fingers behind your back, it was one of those little things to sort of be able to lie without any bad conscience. Okay, you can go and sit down. And then he invited the priest up. And the judge said the same thing, were you gambling? And very quickly, before the judge could see, he looked up at the sky and said, please forgive me. And said, no. And the judge said, I'll go and sit down. Then it was a Buddhist monk. And we can't cross our fingers behind our back. And also we can't just look up at the sky and say, God, please forgive me. So the judge said, monk, were you gambling? And the monk replied, with whom? The moral of that story is, no, don't be the first or the second, always be the last. But that never happened. You know, monks and priests, they don't gamble like that. So what, did I tell a lie? No, it wasn't, it doesn't count. That's not what a lie really means. That's just a joke. And you never believed that was true anyway. So, well, I hope not anyway. So that's what the Buddha was meaning to Rahula. If it's like a lie, you know, saying, oh, I'll call you tomorrow, and you never mean to, and you do it just for fun, then that is bad. Dear Ajahn, thank you for a most enjoyable retreat. Thought, though I don't know who I am thanking, as there is nothing there, just an empty space, camouflaged perhaps as a monk, as I also am looking, but it's like Darth Vader. Someone told me that in Darth Vader, that when he took off his mask, there was nothing left. Is that right, the movie? Star Wars? You don't know. I don't know. Don't ask me. Anyway, I thought that it was just nobody there. As I also am looking below the last layer of onion, I am not there also, so there's nothing to thank you. Question. You get really confused that way. I have heard Ananda ask the Buddha if he was asleep all those years after awakening, when he slept in that position with his hand supporting his head. He said he was always conscious even when sleeping. Is this true? Does it maybe just mean he was an insomniac? No, I didn't say he was always conscious. It was this, they have this word, it's sampajanya, which means it's always with wisdom, it's always wise sleeping. And it doesn't mean he was awake and mindful when he was sleeping. It meant that he knew the right reason to sleep and he woke up afterwards knowing the right reason to sleep. So it's about sleeping with a purpose. Because there was once this guy Mara again. This Mara was following the Buddha around, trying to catch him out, trying to find any faults. Now sometimes as a teacher, people do that. They start looking at Ajahn Brahm. Does he snore, you know, when he meditates? Does he dribble too? That's the trouble when you're a teacher. People always try to find your faults. So they were trying to find the Buddha's faults. And one day, very hot day, after lunch, the Buddha took a nap. As soon as the Buddha took a nap, the man said, I've caught you out, you lazy bum. You're sleeping while other people are working. You know, what are you doing that for? That's indulging. Why were you sleeping? And the Buddha said, the reason I was sleeping for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. I thought, wow, what a great excuse. So now when I take a nap, I take a nap for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. But no, it's a serious answer. And it was, you know, because the Buddha was a teacher, he needed his energy, he needed his health and long life. So he was sleeping to make sure that his body and mind was fit, healthy, and ready to teach when needed. For the sake of others, not for himself. And so the Buddha was sleeping, and it was for a very good purpose. So you do it for metta, for compassion. Yes, oh, this is an old poem. Yesterday upon the stair, I saw a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish that man would go away. He's gone. That's an old poem. That's many years ago. That old man went a long time ago. There are triple gems and triple gems. Ajahn B. Biancadania. Triple gem. Isn't that nice? 8 stars Lotus Retreat. 8-star retreat. Very good. Thank you so much for the retreat, Ajahn. I feel so much more relaxed and more encouragement to help my own practice. There was a lovely meditation experience, too. Great to have a laugh, too. Very good. Dear Ajahn, can we have a group photograph at end of retreat, please? Thank you. If we do have a group photograph, one camera. And you can share it afterwards. Because I've been on these retreat photographs. They're all standing there. And there's about 10 cameras. So take one. And then someone comes, oh, my one next. And it takes hours for group photographs. So one, if you do one, then that's good enough. Group photograph. But really, if you wanted a group photograph, it should have been in the middle of the retreat, not the end of the retreat. Because when they take a group photograph at the end of my retreat, everyone looks so sad and miserable. Oh, we're going home. Oh, this is terrible. This sucks. I don't want to go home. And they're all crying. You better be, otherwise I'll be very disappointed in the group photograph. I noticed that on some of these other retreats, you'd have these group photographs and everyone would have these beautiful smiles at the end of their retreats. And I really thought that, you know, these very tough retreats, I thought, wow, it's amazing, just the people were radiant, they're so joyful. But how do they have their great smiles? They must have had great meditation. And I asked them afterwards, no, we weren't smiling because we had great meditation. We were smiling because now we could go home. Could you please talk about how right livelihood relates to meditation practice? You once used a metaphor about distinguishing a container from its contents. Could this relate to choice of livelihood? No, livelihood is how you pay your bills. And with right livelihood, as long as it's not the expense of other beings, you know, lives or suffering. So, yeah, I mean, you can make a lot of money, you know, opening up a bar and selling beer and alcohol or drugs, but that harms people, so it's not right livelihood. So, you know, choose a nice right livelihood. You know, like a tea shop is a very good right livelihood. Selling nice cups of tea, and especially to monks. That's right livelihood. I don't know about coffee shop, because I don't really like coffee that much. But a fish and chip shop, yeah, that's right livelihood. Now, in other words, as long as it's not harming or hurting other people, and that's called right livelihood. And there's so many. You know, in the suttas, it used to say that being a prison guard was wrong livelihood. And that was, you know, obviously because in those days, the prison guards would, you know, would torture people and punish people. But in these days, I know many prison guards who come to our center, you know, they're actually doing a social service. You know, the prison officers have actually changed a lot since the time of the Buddha. And so for them, it's, you know, it's quite right livelihood. As long as you're doing a good service. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can animals make karma? Of course they can make karma. Animals can keep precepts. Now, dogs, they keep at least 3 precepts usually. They do. They don't kill. They steal. I must admit, they steal. Adultery, no, I can't stop them. They commit adultery. But they don't lie and they don't take alcohol. I've never seen a dog lie. Don't take alcohol. They don't kill. So, you know, at least they've got 3 precepts. That's much better than some people. No, and of course, dogs are non-judgmental. That's one of the beautiful things about dogs. You know, they just love it. And sometimes you hit them and they still wag their tail. And they always forgive you. Isn't that a beautiful thing about dogs? They're just so forgiving. And sometimes, you know, forget to feed them or you leave them at home. And, you know, you go to the retreat or something. And they still forgive you. They're really good. Also, they are more in the present moment than humans, so shouldn't this make them happier than us? Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at, because every evening I go over to the monastery to make sure everything's going okay over there, and our poor little cat over there, she's got nose cancer, nasal cancer. We, you know, took it to the vet and gave it as much treatment as possible, but it's dying, the poor thing. And, you know, you see that poor cat's nose, you know, it's bleeding, and, you know, we give it some sort of painkillers. But, you know, that cat doesn't moan or groan. It just hangs around and just sleeps when it wants to sleep. And it bears up just so beautifully without so much complaints. And sometimes humans, you could learn so much about animals, you know, how we don't complain and sort of go crazy when we're hurting. It's very, very impressive. Can you explain how the Buddha saw human need for physical affection? Was this important, or does love and compassion fulfill this need? Physical affection, you mean like hugs and other sort of contagious actions? No, physical affection, you can see it's a positive contributions to your well-being and health. But I think in Asia, I mean, I remember seeing in places like Thailand, there was not so much physical contact between people, but there was a huge amount of sort of kindness and love, even though no shaking hands. You know, you just had to do the paying respect, which was actually quite a beautiful thing to do. If you ever shake on people's hands, and sometimes people, they just squash you. It's almost being put in a vice, and you count how many broken bones you've got after they've shaken you. And sometimes their hands are really sweaty and nasty, and you know, you want to sort of, you know, disinfect them after you shake them. And sometimes people want to give you a hug, and you know, they really smell because they haven't sort of, don't use deodorant. So sometimes this could be very dangerous at times. So, but sometimes it's nice to have a hug, it's nice to sort of have some kindness. But I found, like, even in monastic life, you know, just a bit of kind eyes, kind words, and softness, that satisfies. You don't always need to have the touch. It's that the thing behind the touch is the most important. You know, the kind words, the soft tones. That really is nice affection. Ajahn Brahm, what is your greatest strength? What is your greatest weakness? Share with us. Oh, joy, boy. My greatest strength is my humility, and my greatest weakness is my lack of humility. I don't know. The word unreliable makes more sense, or uncontrollable, to let go. Doer's nightmare. I didn't imagine. The word unreliable makes more sense to let go. Unreliable. Okay, I think what you really mean there is everything is unreliable, so you can't depend upon it, so you might as well let it go. If it was really dependable, something you can rely upon, something which is always there for you, then maybe it can help you. But when you can't rely upon it, then let it go. Maybe. Is that what it means? Anyway, that's what you're getting, so you can let it go, because my answers are very unreliable. So please let them go. Uh-oh. Dear emptiness. It's not venerable emptiness. You can show that this is a bad question. I have a bone to pick with you regarding sex. Uh-oh. You say that sex isn't actually enjoyable, yet you haven't had it for 40 years. That's why I haven't had it for 40 years. Sure, sex can be disappointing and frustrating, but so can meditation. Okay. There is a difference. If you are open-minded, relaxed, generous to your partner and to yourself, and can let go of anxieties, fears, self-consciousness, and expectation, then sex will be a truly joyful experience. I would hate for people to to give up on the search for joyful, meaningful sexual experience because you said it wasn't actually any good. With all respect, your Lord is right. Some people are very easy to teach. Some people are very hard to teach. Okay, well, you know, you just pay your money, it takes your choice, it's up to you. But anyway, the difference between meditation and sex. Meditation, you're very peaceful and blissful, you let go. And afterwards, you're just so free. With sex, you may have bliss, you may feel sort of you're giving, but you end up having babies. And that's not free at all. Once you have a kid, that's 19 years in jail, 20 years. Sometimes they never let you go. Anyway, I'm not going to go further on that one. What are your thoughts on music as an aid to meditation? Okay, well, that's why we do the chanting, the age of meditation. That's very musical, isn't it? So sonorous and wonderful. And some music can be okay, but some music can get in your head and keep going round and round and round. That's what sometimes happens in your meditation. You think of an old song, and you can't get it out once it's in there. So be very, very careful. But my favourite song, and actually once, someone asked me, I was a fundraiser for the Nuns Monastery, said, can you sing a song? I jumped up, just for a fundraiser. And so, you know, for the sake of the benefit of the Nuns Monastery, I sang the song. It was one of my favourite groups, was Simon and Garfunkel. And it was The Sound of Silence. I shall now sing The Sound of Silence. A joke. What did the zero say to the eight? Nice belt. Okay, very good. Okay, it's really stupid. When it gets late, people get very stupid. Here's a stupid numbers joke. Why is 2 times 10 the same as 2 times 11? I got this from a kid. Why is 2 times 10 the same as 2 times 11? 2 times 10 is 20. And 2 times 11 is 22. Well, you asked for it. You gave a stupid joke. It's your karma. You get one back. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please name some names of highly realized beings who are living at the moment so we can listen or visit them too? Thank you. Okay. The names of highly realized beings is you. No, because sometimes if we say that this monk is an enlightened being or that nun is an enlightened being, that sometimes that you look at them in a different way. That's why we keep it very quiet, who's an enlightened being, who's not an enlightened being. And anyway, isn't it more important you look at yourself rather than other beings? So look at yourself rather than looking at others. The teachers are just there to show the way. So you have to do it yourself. And it's really awful when we get this cult of, you know, enlightened beings. And what happens? You put them up on pedestals and you worship the monk or worship the nun as an arahat. And then you don't listen to the teachings anymore. You think just giving them gifts will give you lots and lots of merit. And I've seen that so many people that go and see these so-called enlightened monks or nuns. And these enlightened monks and nuns get so many people, they just want to sit with them. They just want to offer things, and no one actually really wants to listen to their teachings anymore. They're just like Buddha statues, you know, to be bowed down and worshipped, but they can't have a chance to speak. So I think it's nice just to stop all that sort of stuff. Because if you're an enlightened being, you're called Arya. And one of the reasons we keep it quiet, because if some monks are Arya and some of the others aren't, we get what we call in English the aristocracy, which are the higher beings. You know what happens to the aristocracy? They get all the privileges and other people don't. The story which I like to tell was when I was a young monk in with Ajahn Chah. The food was disgusting, I've told that many times. Anything which slithered you ate, literally snails. And it would be okay if then you had to cook snails, they just boiled them. So it's like, you know, eating an eraser. That's true, that's what it tasted like. So ants eggs, was it buffalo afterbirth? All disgusting things, frogs. Yeah, it was disgusting. But I remember, you know, the Monty Python, you know, the Monty Python's fried steak. I was an aficionado of that. And they had a sketch in Monty Python about Crunchy Frog, about in a cinema, people serving you Crunchy Frog. And it was the whole joke was how disgusting it was. And somebody brought some Crunchy Frog in the cinema. I said, you've got left the bones in it. Yes, that's why it's crunchy. Ugh, that was sick. That was the joke at the time. And I remember that as a kid, and I laughed my head off at Crunchy Frog. And a few years later, I was eating Crunchy Frog. And that wasn't a joke. So it was really, really disgusting food. But every now and again, someone would come from town, you know, in the city, and they'd bring some food you could eat. You know, it was like nice Thai food. So this one day, I was just sitting there waiting for, you know, the rotten fish curry and the crunchy frogs again. And a pickup truck came, full of pots and pans on the back. And I realized this was from the city, I'm going to get a good meal today. And the guy came out, and it was packed with pots and pans. And the guy came out, and he came in the dining hall where I was waiting, and I heard him say, is Ajahn Chah here? And he was out in a house diner where they do a little blessing ceremony. So I said, no, he's not here today. So the guy got in his car and went away with all the pots. Now that really hurt. I was a young man, not enlightened. I craved that food. And you could see it, you could smell it, and you could see it being driven away. And the reason why is because why waste all of your good dana on, you know, monks like me who weren't enlightened? They only wanted to feed arahats because you get more bang for your bucks feeding enlightened beings. That's why we don't say. Because otherwise you just take the food to the enlightened ones and you give nothing to the others. Three times be excited to Ajahn Brahm, the most emptiest, funniest and cuddliest. Oh, this is a bit teacher of all. Well, I suppose I'm fat enough to be cuddly. Also to Bianca, the best retreat chef in the entire cosmos. And also to Dania, the most caring retreat center caretaker and also compassionate rabbit keeper. Also to all the lovely yogis. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's very nice. Ajahn, without the motivation of sex, there he goes. I should have mentioned sex. Once it comes up, people can't forget it. Why do you keep talking about sex? Go and see a psychiatrist, you guys. Without the motivation of sex, the financial world will collapse. It's collapsing anyway. It's another thing with sex, it's green. Women are not motivated to wear a new dress, make up, perfume, bags, etc. Isn't it wonderful you don't have to wear all that stuff? I felt really, really sort of compassion for you guys, or you girls rather. I remember years ago, going to Melbourne, and had that fashion, we had that, the halter tops, you know, this, the not really sort of blouses. They ended up here somewhere, just below the breasts. And the skirt, which was, you know, just, you know, underneath the belly button. And all this was actually exposed. And this was Melbourne in the winter. And these girls were blue. And I felt, why'd you do that? I mean, you must be such torture just to get a guy. What you do to yourself is just masochistic. And I remember as a kid trying on my mother's high heels. How you can actually walk in those? You know, just a 4 or 5 year old. How can you walk in those stuff? And all that paint on your face. Oh my goodness. So isn't it wonderful? You don't have to wear that stuff. You feel so free. Men are not motivated to please women. No more jewelry, flowers, chocolates, etc. Oh, that's such a relief, because as a guy, you're thinking, no, what does my girlfriend want? What can I get for her? And I used to tear up my hair trying to find out how I could please her. And I got her chocolates, it was the wrong chocolates. Flour, she had hay fever. That's why that guy is, he'd asked his wife, what do you want, for your birthday? And she said something with diamonds. So he got her a pack of playing cards. So difficult with this sex business. They're so free when you're out of all of that. You don't have to sort of, try and sort of impress other people. Okay. Knock, knock, who's there? Joke 3, deep. Yeah, that is deep. A bit hard for me. Anyway, I'll think about that. Maybe I'll get insight into it later on. How many of your retreats are we allowed to go to? One or all of them? Is it the first to register that gets in, or is there a limit of one retreat a year? Look, I've really taught as best I possibly could. You have an 8-star retreat. You've got a great sort of caretaker, a beautiful cook. If you can't get enlightened on this retreat, you're a hopeless case. I used to say that, a school teacher, imagine you were a school teacher and people came back to your class year after year after year after year. You get the sack as a school teacher. If you're teaching sort of grade 4 maths, at the end of the year they came back again. Another grade 4 maths class, another grade 4 maths class. So I must be a terrible teacher. You guys want to come back again? Graduate! Now, you're allowed to come back as many times as you like. But don't come back too soon. Because if you come back too soon, you remember all the stories and the jokes. Wait long enough till you forget them. So I can tell them again and you might even laugh. Hi, Jan. How many of you... Oh, sorry, I got that one already. Have you seen that Buddhist statue in South Korea in an ancient monastery? It faces out to the ocean. It is a World Heritage Site. Forget the actual name of it. Quite stunning. I've never been to South Korea. You're Korean. A big Buddha statue which faces out to the sea? Have you seen that one? He lives in Korea. He hasn't seen it. So a big Buddha statue that sits down. No, I haven't seen it. It is quite stunning. Does it? Are you sure it's stunning? Does it stun the fish if it faces out to sea? They come up and they go, oh, and the fish and the fishermen catch them. No, that's not very nice, is it? It should be pacifying and calm. That's a really nice Buddha statue. It's very hard to get a good Buddha statue, because a real Buddha statue should, number one, be androgynous. Now, not male, not female, but halfway in between. Because this is a Buddha. It's not a man. It's not a woman. It's halfway in between. And should also have a nice, peaceful smile. Happy, but calm. And not be imposing. Be friendly. It's a very, very difficult thing for a sculptor, to catch the image of a Buddha. And when they do, it's amazing. You look upon it and you feel peaceful. You feel welcomed. You feel happy. And that's a great Buddha statue. And it can give you a lot of reassurances. In my life, I've seen Buddha statues in some of the strangest of places. One of my monks went to go and visit England. He was an Australian. And going to visit England, the host decided one day, he had a free morning, to take him to go and see an English castle. You're an Australian, never seen a castle before. So they took him to a castle, but it was closed. So all the plans went sort of amok. And he thought, where else can I take you? And not far away from the castle, which was closed, was Chartwell, which was the country home of Sir Winston Churchill, the famous wartime Prime Minister of England. And so they took him to this country home of Chartwell. They had to pay to get in. And as they went through the entrance of the house where Winston Churchill used to live, at the entrance was a painting of a Buddha statue, a Burmese Buddha statue. And the monk couldn't ask, why is that? What's that doing there? And the curator said that was painted by Winston Churchill. He painted that Buddha statue. And he said it was a painting of a Buddha statue which he had by his bedside throughout the Second World War. And he said he had it by his bedside to give him confidence, uplift, peace during the darkest days of that terrible war, with all the responsibility, you know, he had to take for thousands of people's lives, hundreds of thousands of people's lives, making the toughest decisions you could ever make. And he had a Buddha statue there by his bed every night. And you know the statue which his wife had, Clementine? She had a Kuan Yin statue next to her bed. Closet Buddhists. Were they? I don't know, even if they weren't a Buddhist. The image of a Buddha was something which gave them peace, which is why so many gardens have Buddha statues, especially in places like Australia. Why do they have Buddha statues in the gardens? Because it's a symbol of peace. So there we go. Dear friends, you all have something special in you which I love. Please develop this in you and see the same in all others, including those you do not like much. Only by doing this, you will make peace in yourself with love. A budding teacher there, so you can go and teach the next retreat. Dear Ajahn, after Nirvana, what else? God, you're so demanding. You give your Nirvana, you want something more. What is the difference between the Sutra of Mahayana tradition, Hua Yan Jin, and the Theravada ones? Are they both in the form of complete translation from Sutra in Sanskrit, Sadhu? Okay, the Mahayana tradition and the Theravada tradition. These ancient texts were taken over from India a long time ago, and some of them came down to Sri Lanka, some of them went up to China, and the ones which went to Sri Lanka are more reliable. They're older, but they're not always the most reliable. And some of the Chinese texts are actually more accurate than the Pali ones, as modern scholars have found. So what we've been doing, we've been collating them, comparing them, and comparing them, taking the best from each. These days we're getting much closer to what the Buddha actually taught than ever before. It's a wonderful time. So nobody's got the perfect teachings of the Buddha, but we bring them all together and compare them and find out the very, very best. And that's a great bit of scholarship we have these days, because Buddhism, it spread to many different countries. And as it spread to different countries, the center which was in India, you know, used to be like the headquarters, but when the Muslims invaded in the 13th century, they basically destroyed the headquarters. And so that really drove a wedge between the northern schools of Buddhism and the southern schools of Buddhism. And because of that historic and geographic separation, you know, the different schools, they developed separately, and we always thought that there was a great difference. But these days we come together, we learn each other's languages, translate each other's books, and the different types of Buddhism become really, really close. They're coming much closer today than ever before. Even next week, I am going to teach in Hong Kong in a Mahayana temple with the Theravada abbot and Mahayana nuns. And it works really well. And there's no problem, you know, living in the same temple. And that's wonderful to know that, because we're monks, we're nuns, and that's enough. The differences between us are just so superficial. And isn't that what we really want in these days? There's too many separations. Too many separations between this sect and that group and that particular, you know, yana. And it's just too much. So there's an old saying, big vehicle, small vehicle. You know that's the big separation in Buddhism in the past. Big vehicle, small vehicle. All vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. That's a very nice saying. This is the last question. That short metta meditation from this morning seems like something Mr. Bean would do. What was that one this morning? Oh yeah, the little presents. Would Mr. Bean do that? That must be why he's very happy and very rich. So now, that's a worthwhile doing when you put something in a little box and give it to yourself. Because no one else can give you peace and forgiveness. Only you can. That's something which I recognized a long time ago, and I've taught people for many, many years now. You can seek forgiveness from people you've hurt, and they may come up and say, I forgive you. But it doesn't really make much difference. The biggest difference comes when you say to yourself, I forgive me. That's the only time when the forgiveness really solves a problem and you can move forward. So seeking forgiveness from a Buddha statue, from a Jesus, from a monk or whatever, it really, really doesn't help. You have to forgive yourself. And just being encouraged to do that, being told by someone you respect, it's allowable, it can be done, it should be done. That is so helpful. And then, in your own time, in your own place, in the quiet moments of your life, you look at all the things you've done. You put them in perspective with all the beautiful stuff which you've done, and you forgive yourself. You allow yourself to be. And you're not anymore fighting with your past. And it's such a beautiful thing of freedom to forgive everything which you've ever done in the past. All the stupid stuff which you have done. And we've all done stupid stuff in the past. I told this story once. I told it actually in Open the Door of Your Heart. I hope you've forgotten it. I decided one day to make a public confession. Because, you know, even monks make mistakes sometimes. And so in a big crowd of people in Nolamara, I made a confession that some years previously I'd had some of the happiest times in my life. Beautiful times, beautiful moments. In the arms of another man's wife. It's true. She was married to someone else. And we kissed. We embraced. It was so wonderful. And she belonged to another man.
I can't keep a straight face.
That was my mother. You get it? Some of the happiest times of my life, embracing, kissing in the arms of another man's wife. That man was my father, she was my mum. It's very easy to jump to conclusions, isn't it? How many of you actually thought, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm's committed adultery? But it's a trick. And the moral of that story is, don't jump to conclusions. You add one and one together and get three. It sounds like, you know, it's adultery, but when you tell the full story, it wasn't. You know, it's acceptable, you know, to kiss and hug your mum, even though she's married to somebody else. So, there we go. That is the last question of this retreat. So, thank you all for asking all those questions. Have you got all the answers now? No, because questions never stop. So when the monks are away, when the nuns are away, and you have to ask a question, who should you ask? You ask yourself. And when you find out the answer yourself, then that's when you really become wise. Because a lot of times, so we can give answers, but the best answer is telling a person how to find out for themselves. So if you have any deep questions, ask the question and then be quiet. And leave it alone. And when you meditate deeply, the answer just comes up in its own time. You don't have to keep thinking about it. That's where you can never find the right answer. Ask a question, be quiet, forget it, and later on, after it's worked its way through your mind, a great answer will come up. And that's so reliable. And number two, don't think about it. Feel it. Feel what the right answer is. Because even research done last year over in, I think it was Europe or US somewhere, they wanted to test out which is more reliable, intuition or reason, logic. And as I said the story earlier, intuition, feeling the answer, is much more reliable than thinking it through. So if you've got a question, feel the answer. and you'll know what's right or what's wrong. You think about it and it gets all complicated. So you don't need to be a university graduate to be wise. Just feel it and you'll know what's right, what's wrong. And if ever, like a few people were asking during the interviews, if ever you have to make decisions in life, the best way of making decisions, just make it. It really doesn't matter, because there is no such thing as a right decision or a wrong decision. They're just different, that's all. And the reason it's not right or wrong, because good, bad, who knows? And that's a beautiful little story, because that means you don't have to worry so much. At the time, there's no way that you can know which is the best decision. So just make a decision and forget about it. Just go forward. And it doesn't matter which way you decide to go, whether it's left or right. If you go out of this retreat center tomorrow and you turn right or you turn left, you still get back to Perth. It doesn't really matter which way you go. You go right, it's the quickest way. You go left, it's the prettiest way. Go past the prison and past the dam. So which is the best way? I don't know. They're both okay. Good, bad, who knows? So because of that, in life, you make a decision, don't worry about it, you just make it work. There was another story about good, bad, who knows, which I wanted to say. It was a story about a man who came and told me this over in Perth. He said one of the things which changed his whole life was when he was in Mumbai doing business. And his business was finished. He ordered a taxi from the hotel to take him to the airport. And the taxi was a bit late, but still in plenty of time. So he got in the taxi, but the problem was the taxi got lost on the way to the airport. Even though this was a local taxi driver, he got the streets wrong. He was wandering around the streets of Bombay, totally lost, as the clock was ticking. And of course, if you've got a plane to catch, you start getting a bit frantic, you know, when the clock ticks and it's going to be touch and go whether you can check in on time. He was still lost, but he thought that because this was India and many times the planes are delayed, there was a chance. If the plane had delayed, he could still make his flight. But when they actually did find the airport, he knew his plane had left on time because he saw it. He saw it taking off. And he was so angry at the taxi driver, shouting and swearing and scolding the stupid taxi driver. Because of his incompetence, he'd missed his flight. And he was still getting angry at the taxi driver when he saw his flight fall from the sky, crash with everyone on board killed. That's a true story. There was actually a guy who comes to the Armadale group. He said he was on that flight, I think coming from some place. He actually got off that flight. And it was that very flight. And that man who saw the flight, which he should have been on, crashed to the ground, turned around to the taxi driver. "You wonderful man, you're such a great taxi driver. How could I ever reward you?" Being late for the flight, was it good or bad? He thought it was terrible. But when he saw it come down, he said, "Wow, such a good thing." And apparently that changed his life. So he doesn't get angry at things, because when things go wrong, it might be saving your life. So no need to get angry. Good, bad, who knows? So, you've now built up so much good karma asking all these questions. You've built up so much energy with all this mindfulness. You've got so much momentum with all your meditation. As I said with that story, the guy went to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, never got paid, but Friday was his payday. And Friday is the last day of the week. And this is the last day of the meditation retreat. This is payday. So are you going to go to bed? Are you going to waste the last night? Are you going to go there and give up the opportunity to meditate all night? If you are, you're going to do what I'm going to do and go to bed. Now just take it easy. The path keeps going on. There's no real end to the spiritual path. Yeah, now you're in the retreat and you're meditating here. Tomorrow you'll be meditating somewhere else. Life goes on, the journey continues. But really remember all that you've heard and learnt, learning how to let go and make peace and have fun in your life. You don't need to be so tense. The present moment is the most important one, so be in this moment and have some joy in this moment. Make peace, be content, and you feel so free. All those things which you learn. You know what happens sometimes after a retreat, 2 or 3, 4, 5 days later? You get the paycheck. Weird. But sometimes on a retreat you're getting nowhere and you think nothing's happened. And you go home, and at the most unexpected time, you're in the kitchen or in the bedroom or in the garden, you sit down, and the mind gets peaceful really quickly. The paycheck has come. Well done. So just because you leave, it doesn't mean it's all over. It's continuing. It's working. Inside your mind, in the dark, inaccessible recesses, the Dharma is working. The peace is happening. Nirvana is working its way through your system. And one day, burp, and it all comes out. Or something like that, anyway. I'm getting tired, enough. Okay, so, 3 enormous sadhus. Sadhu! 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 Okay, so I expect lots of tears tomorrow. The end of the retreat, I don't want to go home. Anyway, have a nice night. See you tomorrow morning.